Welcome to the Launch University Podcast, turning good intentions into reality in your career, business, and life.
Hey everybody, this is David Farmer, and thank you for taking the time to join us for Launch University's podcast today. I'm really excited about the story that you're going to get to hear. I've got Justin Miller with me, and Justin is one of the founders of Care for AIDS, and he has an unbelievable story that he can tell about a launch that he got involved with a number of years ago when he was a college student that is thriving today. Justin is based in Atlanta, but as you're going to hear, he jets across the world on a regular basis over to Africa. And so, Justin, I want to thank you for taking time out to come be with me today and to share your story with the Launch University tribe.
No, thank you, David. I'm thrilled to be here.
Let's just get into it. Tell everybody a little bit about your personal story, where you are today, but then take us back in time to that point where you decided you were going to launch what is now known as Care for AIDS.
Yeah. Well, David, as you said, I live here in Atlanta with my wife of now 7 years. We met when we were in college in Nashville, Tennessee, and we have a 2-year-old daughter. And so the most important roles in my life right now are husband and father. But for the past 7 years, I've also been the CEO of this organization called Care for AIDS. And it was about 10 years ago when my life took a very unexpected turn. I was raised here in Atlanta to a dad who works for Chick-fil-A. I had always looked to the corporate world and marketplace as where I wanted to aspire to. And I went off to Vanderbilt University to pursue that dream. And it, as I said, it took an unexpected turn. I was attending a conference in 2006 where I was listening to Bono give a challenge to the audience that day about the church's role in responding to HIV.
And you were in college at the time.
I was in college. I was 18 years old. So an unlikely person, to say the least. I didn't have the experience of the entire crowd there that day. I didn't have the resources, didn't have the connections. So I felt very ill-equipped to tackle this challenge. But Bono stood before that audience and said, "This is one of the greatest humanitarian crises of our generation." And as entrepreneurs know, we usually either get our start by feeling like there's something that isn't that should be, or there's something that should not be the way it is and that needs to be fixed. And that set in me this discontent with this issue of HIV. And I had never been exposed to it before. I did not know anyone that had HIV. It was not personal for me. But there was just something I couldn't shake. I felt like we needed to do more. And at 2006, this was a pretty popular issue in our media. That has changed since then. I'm sure we'll talk about that at some point. But that kind of set me on this course at 18 to investigate, what is HIV? How is it affecting our world? And what is my responsibility to do something about it?
So inspired by the challenge that you heard Bono share, what do you do with that?
That's a great question. And it took me about 9 months to figure out what is my response. And I didn't have the understanding. And as you talk about on this podcast, the understanding is the first step to any concept. And we didn't have any idea of what the scope or the complexity of this issue was. And so our first step was just say, we've got to learn about this. We can't even formulate a plan or really an idea unless it's based in just the reality of HIV. And so that set us on a path to travel to Kenya with a few buddies of mine for a period of about a month where we didn't have any agenda, we didn't have any plan besides, of course, our itinerary, but we did not have a prescription about what we thought needed to be done. We just went in to learn and to understand. And we spent a month in Kenya, and it opened our eyes to so much of what was going on there.
So I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment, because I would have to admit that by nature, I'm a planner. So the idea that I don't really have a clear plan, but I'm going to take a month and go to Africa and just dig into this, understand, that's a little bit outside my comfort mode. But what I want to point out to the listeners is I love the fact that you took a step. And so I think what I learned from this is you don't have to have it all figured out sometimes. If you've got this passion, if you have this confidence that you know you need to be addressing an opportunity or an issue, sometimes you're just going to have to take a step before you get some of the added clarity you need. And it sounds like that's perhaps what happened for you and your friends.
Absolutely. And that may sound like a big leap, but it really was just a small step. And if we had gone and nothing had really come of that, you know, we've lost a little time, a little resources, but we haven't made such an overwhelming commitment that we're really set back. And so I think just taking that step, exploring and seeing what we can learn from that was really important.
So what'd you do while you were there in Africa?
Well, we couldn't have planned this. And this is part of my story that I attribute completely to God's providence, is that we got connected leading up to that trip to two Kenyan leaders who were extremely passionate about this issue. And they were a gift to us. We did not have a clue about what we were walking into. And these two leaders there in Kenya had an idea that they wanted to launch. And David, as you've done with this podcast, I felt like part of my responsibility and really passion for this work was yes, to see people with HIV cared for, but it was also to see this idea that these two Kenyan men had, to see that grown into fruition and bring that to life. And I felt like they had reached a point where they weren't going to be able to bring that to launch. And so that was part of what compelled me to get into this work as well, is seeing these two Kenyan leaders named Cornell and Duncan. And so they guided us around the country for a month as we interviewed hundreds of people about HIV. And as I said, we didn't know exactly what we were looking for. And that gave us an incredible blank slate to learn. We asked questions broadly. We weren't looking for any particular answer. And when we got to the end of that trip, we realized there was this aha moment of, we understand now the need that exists here and how this potential organization that wasn't even born yet and the local church could work together to do something amazing to reach people that had really been forgotten or overlooked.
So you get to the end of this experience, probably a remarkable, even life-changing kind of experience. Uh-oh, it's time to go back to school. What are we going to do now? And so how do you figure out the next step?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there was a very strong likelihood, and I'm afraid this happens all too much, is that that little vision that was just starting to be born in me could have easily gone out, and it could have easily just been, I have too many demands on me and I have to go back to school and I'm dating this girl and I'm in this fraternity and I've got these things on me. And I'm so glad that we kind of fanned that into this organization, but we really didn't know exactly where to start. We were going to produce a documentary. We started down that road and then we said, no, this is an organization. And we need to create an arm of this in the U.S. to help support and fund what Cornell and Duncan want to do in Kenya. And at times, as much as I wanted to walk away from that, because I knew that embarking on this journey had many implications for me, I felt a weight of responsibility, not a burden, but just a responsibility to take this amazing idea that could solve an incredibly big problem that's not just a problem of convenience, but it's a problem of life and death. And I felt that I needed to take responsibility for that and step into, with that knowledge and understanding, and step into that role of leading an organization. And there has not been a day in the last decade that I've looked back and regretted taking that step. It was absolutely the thing that I was supposed to do. And I think and believe that we've made a huge impact because of that.
So a couple things I'm taking out of this story. One is the importance of critical relationships. So meeting Cornell and Duncan in Kenya was huge, because I know they're still very much involved in your organization today. I've had the chance to get to know them a little bit. And then thinking you might go in one direction, make a documentary film, when in fact you ultimately realize you need to go in another direction, That's okay. That's par for the course. Talk about, as you transitioned away from the documentary idea, how did you begin to craft the model for what care for AIDS would ultimately be?
Yeah, and let me comment on that documentary just for a second, because that was the first of many times on this journey where I felt like we had to let go of something that could have easily held us captive to something that wasn't really helping us move towards that desired future. And I'm so thankful for wise counsel and just the encouragement of others to say there's a time to reinvent and to relaunch and to figure something out. And there's also a time to say, no, that chapter's done. We need to put our energy and resources towards the next thing. And that was one of those times where I think if we had gone down the path of trying to create the documentary, we might have forfeited the opportunity to see Care for AIDS become the organization that it is.
Let's talk about what it is. Can I go there?
Of course.
And then we'll kind of back into how you got there.
Yeah.
Because that's 2006 when this all kicked off. Here we are in 2017. Give everybody a sense of what Care for AIDS is today, and then we can kind of talk about how you got there.
Well, I have to admit, it is a far bigger organization, which is not the only indicator of success, but it has been far greater than what we could have imagined. We started with an idea of opening 5 centers in Kenya, and I can tell you what a center is later, but today we have 40 centers across Kenya and Tanzania. We employ over 100 full-time African staff, and each of those centers is serving 80 families at a time. These are families who are in the most vulnerable physical and economic position in their community, and we are coming in to intervene to provide them with the resources and the trainings and the support that they need to be able to really sustain their life, for one, but also to be empowered as an individual to lead their family, to earn an income, to raise their kids, educate their kids. And it's really about preserving that family and preventing children from becoming orphans. And so at any given time, we've got about 3,200 families going through our program that represent about 10,000 children. And some portion of those children, if not a majority of those children, would end up becoming orphans if there hadn't been some kind of intervention in their parents' life. And that's the mission that we're on today, and we're just expanding into Tanzania. We're already looking at Uganda about a year from now, so we're in a period of rapid growth.
So if I could add a little bit of color to the story, I've not been to Africa, not been to Kenya, but as I've gotten to know you and my wife Mallory got to know you, she was really intrigued by this idea. And so Mallory and 2 of my kids, Reagan and Kristen, had the opportunity to go over to Kenya with you this past summer in 2016. And so they spent about a week and a half over there. They talked about going to some of the most incredible, really challenging slums you can probably find anywhere there in Kenya. Yet they totally resonated with the people. And I know Mallory came back and said, okay, this is legit. It's unbelievable what you guys are doing. And so my understanding is you're able to provide, help the families where someone might be suffering with HIV get the medicine they need to stay healthy, literally stay alive, as you said, avoid losing life and then leaving orphans behind. You're helping them with work, kind of getting their finances together, their overall life together, spiritual well-being to go along with the physical well-being. You put them through a program that lasts how many weeks?
For 9 months.
9 months, okay. And then they literally can graduate from that program.
That's right.
Once their health is better, you've stabilized the family unit, their finances are in a better place.
That's exactly right. It's well said. And there are a lot of different organizations working on this issue. The sliver that we're in is about 1% of our resources are going to help provide these complementary services that are needed in addition to just the testing and the treatment of HIV and the education programs that teach about it. Those are vitally important, but we felt like there was a real gap in services in helping provide all of these different type of services, counseling, job training, helping them with savings and finance and spiritual care and community health issues. Those are things that we felt like had been largely overlooked. And we get to do that through the local church. We are a faith-based organization, but the local church is an amazing resource to provide care at the lowest community level. And you cannot replicate that with clinics or hospitals, but using the local church as a safe and affordable and discreet and convenient location to provide care is just an amazing, amazing tool.
So by working with the churches there, you're finding leaders who can and come alongside and help reach out to these families that are impacted. And you're also, it gives you a little bit of infrastructure, a place to come, a place to meet, a place to train for 9 months.
Absolutely. The church facility itself is actually our location, so we don't have to create our own buildings or rent space. We can operate out of the churches. The pastors of that church become advocates for this issue, which the church has largely not done in the past. So to change the conversation among churches about how we as a church should respond with compassion to people with HIV as opposed to, you know, pushing them out, that's also just changing the stigma in a community. The church's perspective on HIV is one that really ripples throughout the community. And we see that not only are individual families getting healed, but the community is viewing HIV in a new light, and the community economy is being stimulated as our clients are going back to work. So it's the primary focus is the individual and the family, but the church and the community are a secondary outcome that we hope to see transformed.
So a couple things I'm picking up as we go through this conversation, Justin. One is that you've figured out a strategy that enables you to take your resources and channel them into the programs that are helping your clients the most and not have to put it into capital programs, buildings and such. So I think that's really powerful. Two, I love the fact that you're really good. You can explain a pretty complicated model in a succinct fashion. And I've heard you say we're in the orphan prevention business.
That's right.
Just comment on that for a moment.
Yeah, this is something that has been really tough for us. When you think about the issue of HIV, it's not a topic that is, if you could say, on trend right now. It's been largely forgotten about, but it is still a hugely pressing issue in our world today. And so we're an organization that's a faith-based organization working with adults with HIV in Kenya and Tanzania. And all of a sudden, you realize that there are not a lot of people out there looking for that organization. And even at times, HIV can be a barrier to connecting with people who don't either understand or really care about that issue. And so for us, we've had to be very intentional to figure out how to connect with people here in the U.S. who support our work. And it's probably, David, been the biggest challenge that we've faced, and choosing ways to help people connect, not to water down the message, but to say, we are really helping prevent children from becoming orphans. And that's an idea that people can really resonate with. And then we can take them deeper into the issue of HIV. And that's something that we've learned over 10 years of how do we help people understand this issue that they've never encountered or they've never really thought about here in the U.S.?
And you really can keep these adults who've contracted HIV alive. And that surprises a lot of folks.
It does. It does. And I can't fault anyone for that because I was that person when I started this. But with the proper treatment and the proper environment, someone with HIV can live for 25, 30 additional years. And that was what really broke my heart, was that people were not realizing that full potential. They were dying in 3 to 5 years after infection, and then someone else was having to bear the responsibility and the cost of caring for those children. And I also just believe that a child, whenever possible, should be raised in a home by parents, and that's going to give that child the best opportunity for success. And there are other things that are necessary, because that's not always going to be the case, but there weren't a lot of organizations, and I'm seeing more, and I'm very happy about that are focusing on how do we keep children in families as opposed to caring for children once they've already been orphaned.
Because there's already a huge issue with orphans in Kenya anyway. It's not like we need to compound that problem anymore.
Probably about 1.5 million orphans in Kenya.
Wow.
And we like to think our clients have represented about 25,000 children to date, and we like to think we've kept those 25,000 children from becoming orphans.
That's incredible. How many clients do you think you've worked with now over the course of the life of Care for AIDS?
More than 8,000 now in our history, and with 3,200 a year, that number is growing rapidly.
So we like to, when we talk about Launch University, we like to say, you know, you begin with good intentions. Clearly, you had good intentions, but it's our hope to encourage you and help coach you through stories and just process to take those good intentions and figure out how you can literally become a difference maker and sustain it. And you've clearly done that, Justin. What an unbelievable story for you, Cornell, for Duncan, and those that are part of your team. I mean, that is, when you talk about saving lives, unbelievable. I want to unpack some of the lessons that you've learned along the way that can help somebody, whether you're involved in some type of ministry effort or you're working on a business project or a little side hustle that you might have. There are still probably some lessons that they're common to all of us. And so I might just begin by asking you, what are some of the big challenges that you've faced as you look back over time, going from just an idea, a stirring in your soul to get after this, to here you are today, you said, with 100 staff on the ground in Africa?
Yeah. I would say that one of our biggest challenges, but probably also the thing that has been one of the greatest contributors to our success, has been our ability to stay focused. Especially working in a place like Kenya in the slums, you can throw a rock in any direction and you can see a problem that needs to be addressed. And to take on the responsibility to solve all of those problems is just, it's unrealistic. It's unsustainable. And the pressures of that you experience as you experience success after your launch, sometimes those things can undermine the very activities that made you successful in the first place. And I think for us, we've had so many opportunities to extend or add to or shift our services in such a way to try to accommodate another request or need that we observed. And we have said, no, we are going to be focused on mobilizing the church to care for families affected by HIV, both physically and spiritually. And as a result, we've had to say no to a lot of things. We, early in the day of going to Kenya, I remember that our team there on the ground had started a program on weekends to help provide a feeding program for children that were not getting fed on the weekends because they weren't in school. And I looked at that, I looked at our mission, and I said, these don't match, and we're going to have to kill this children's program because it's going to distract us from what we set out to do. And as hard as that decision was and as gut-wrenching it was to pull resources from something that I know was doing good, I believe that set a tone for our organization that said, we are going to be focused on this one thing, and only in the situation where we really feel like there's some kind of other related work that really still fits within our mission will we kind of venture outside of that. But I would say that our focus in the same direction over a long period of time is kind of like Jim Collins's flywheel principle. I mean, there has not been a moment in the last 10 years where we've had just explosive growth, but we have been pushing consistently in the same direction over 10 years. And we're now seeing that flywheel begin to spin and pick up momentum. And I think for us, it is so easy to get distracted by so many opportunities. And it's also easy as you grow to want to not take as many risks and not try anything that's new. And that's interesting because it's usually the risk that you took in the beginning that got you to where you are. But fighting against that pull to say, no, we're going to be more conservative, we're going to be more responsible, we're not going to take as many risks. There's a lot of things that as you grow tend to work against the things that made you successful in the first place.
Okay, that's really good stuff. So focus is huge. When you talk about focus, it reminds me a little bit as I read Walter Isaacson's biography on Steve Jobs. One of my learnings from that book was Apple is so successful because Jobs was so good at saying, no, we're not going to do that. That's a good idea, but that's not the best idea. And he limited the scope of the work and said, it's got to just be off the charts good. And I think that has been a big part of Apple's success. So I hear you saying there's so many other things we could be doing because there are so many needs and opportunities that we see. But we're going to stick to our knitting. This is our calling. And so good for you. And then the other lesson I heard you talk about is when you do that, there is a compounding effect that takes place over the course of time. You may not feel it at first. It may be slow go for a while, but you stay in your lane. You keep going. You keep chipping away at it. And then you really do begin to build momentum. And I you're feeling that momentum right now.
We are. And it's a great feeling because it does feel for like a long time we were just pushing really, really hard and not getting the momentum that we wanted. But pushing hard in the same direction doesn't also mean that we kind of kept our blinders on and our heads down. We were constantly scanning the environment and looking to make sure, you know, you don't want to become so heads down that you forget to look up and say, are we still on course? Are we still achieving what we set out to achieve? And HIV has changed a lot in the last 10 years, but our model still seems to be really on point. But don't confuse being focused on being completely heads down and having your blinders on and forgetting to look around and saying, hey, are we missing opportunities? Are we off course? And those are things that we've had to learn as well.
Was there a point along the way where you felt like this whole thing may start to unravel or there's a threat that may do us in? Any big, big challenge like that? Or has it been a series of smaller issues you've had to work through?
It's been a lot of small issues. I will say some of the biggest things that threatened to kind of end the organization were probably in the very early days. We started the organization with the idea, and this goes back to launching something. We launched, the first thing that we wanted to do was we wanted to get churches in the U.S. to partner with us to support a church in Kenya that was operating a Care for AIDS center. And so we went out and we hit the streets and we started talking to churches and casting vision and telling about all the great things that we were going to do if they gave us support. And keep in mind, this was actually about this time, it was 2008, and things were about to unravel.
Yeah, economy's about to tank here in the U.S., big recession.
Big recession coming up. And we realized after about 100 no's that, you know, being 19, having no really proven track record, and just seeing churches at the time not be able to prioritize global missions as a key focus, we realized this is maybe the end for us. And we had to go back and re-examine what we were about. And we said, no, there's a different audience of people that we need to connect to. And we haven't since given up on partnering with churches. And we're now seeing 10 years later, just a resurgence of church support for what we do. But it has taken a long time to get back to that point.
You know, one observation I have is sometimes when you're early on, people don't know if they're ready to fully commit to support you because they don't know if this is, yeah, you're passionate, but I don't know if this thing's going to really be sustainable. But it feels like as you demonstrate, no, we're committed. We're fully committed. We've been at it for years. Here's our track record. And I've seen you've done a really good job of putting together communication materials, videos and print materials that share your story. It gets a little bit, you have more credibility.
Yeah.
And do you find that it gets a little more, it gets a little easier for people to believe that they really can come alongside and help you make a difference?
Absolutely. And we probably spend less on print materials today than we did on day one because we have so much, proven impact that we can point to. And in the early days, we just wanted to be taken seriously. And I was 19, and that also was a little bit of a disadvantage, but I also think it was a huge advantage because they were excited to see what a 19-year-old was trying to do. And they gave me, I probably had unprecedented access to certain people and opportunities that would not have been afforded to somebody that was twice my age. And so I see there's both sides of this. There's the positive side of doing this when I was really young, had a lot of people rooting for me, supporting me, but also wanted to have a seat at the table and wanted to be taken seriously. And so we invested a lot in storytelling and materials and things really early on to say, we may not have the impact of the results to show yet, but we want you to understand as clearly as we can communicate the vision that we have for this.
I am a huge believer that you better be able to do a great job of casting vision.
Yeah.
You got to have your story down, and it's got to be told in a way that's compelling, it's tight, it's succinct. So if you're a launcher out there, put yourself through a little audit. Is your story where it needs to be? Are some of the collateral materials you're using to help tell the story, are they up to par? If not, that could be an opportunity for you.
David, I want to add one thing. David Wills is a friend here in Atlanta, and he told me that the four things that you need to generate or to cultivate generosity in somebody is you need the vision, you need passion, you need results, and you need gratitude. And you need to live constantly in that cycle of those four things. And that's one of the things that has made us so successful, I think, is that we rely on the generosity of other people. And in those early days, we didn't have the results to show for it, but we doubled down on vision, passion, and gratitude. And every person that we supported us along the way, we tried to just overly thank them genuinely for their support. And I think people could see, even at 19, the passion that we had. And the vision was not as strong and as well-defined as it is today, but there was clearly a vision for the future. And so when you have those four, though, working in conjunction with each other, which I think we do today, that has been just a magic combination for us.
All right, I've never heard that before, but I really like that. So vision, passion, results, and gratitude. And as I'm listening to you, Justin, I think this has application for a for-profit enterprise as well, not just a ministry or nonprofit venture. You may not be looking for folks that are going to help underwrite financially the cause, but you're looking for customers. And this whole idea works there too. I want to spend my money with organizations that have a vision. I want to see the passion that the business or the venture has. I want to know about the results that are going to come about for this. And I love it when they thank me that I'm part of their brand, their business. So that's a great model. I love
that. It's a strong model. And David Wills was kind enough to give that to us.
All right. So you probably have folks that come up to you, whether they are working in nonprofit world, or maybe they've got a little business that they want to get going, or maybe they're just working on a big project, and they ask you, Justin, I'm going to launch. Give me a couple of pointers. What are some critical things I need to take into account if I want to be successful? What do you tell them?
Say, are you ready?
How do I know if I'm ready?
Well, I meant more from a personal standpoint.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of people that imagine their launch being a launch and then a quick exit. And there are some organizations that go that trajectory. But a lot of times you're entering into something that is, you're going to be in it for the long haul, as I have. And I'm amazed today. I'm so thankful that I'm 10 years into this, and I feel as energized and passionate about the work as I did on day one. But there are a lot of entrepreneurs that they don't look at their own self-care in the right way to know, hey, can I meet the demands of this? Because it is going to be a challenging road. And that's part of the joy of being an entrepreneur. It's part of the fun in it. I've heard someone say that entrepreneurs are the only people that will work 80 hours a week to avoid working 40.
That's good.
And I love that idea, but we do have so many demands on us, and I think—
And maybe didn't even know they just worked 80 hours, too.
Right, exactly. It's just they lost track of that time. But I believe no venture and no enterprise is as important as the person themselves and their other responsibilities they wear. They have such as a marriage or being a parent, and this is just it's an important work, but it's not the most important work. And I have to remember, as I'm thinking about saving lives in Kenya, I mean, what could be more important than that? But that my first responsibility is to my family, to my own personal health, so I can sustain for the long haul. And that's my goal for the next 40 years. I want to be fit to be able to lead, whether it's Care for AIDS or something else, for the long haul. And I think we can come out of the gates too fast in a launch and just completely burn out, or we want to scale too quickly. And scale is not bad. And there's times when we need to scale quickly. But the disciplined growth that we've had at Care for AIDS has been really, really beneficial to us. And it's allowed us to build a strong culture, to build the right systems. And so I just would say, you know, as an entrepreneur, to look at themselves and say, am I ready? And when you start something, you, as I did, you start with kind of this I believe a lot of times this kind of uninformed like optimism about what it is. And then at some point pretty soon after that, you realize that you enter this period of informed pessimism where you realize how hard it's really going to be. And so I would never discourage anybody from launching, but just have you counted the cost of what this is going to take? And are you prepared personally to manage the demands of that?
That's great. As we kind of wrap up, talk about where Care for AIDS is going. Unbelievable trajectory to get to where you are today. What's next? I mean, how do you continue to think about vision? You've probably had to rework your vision a number of times over the course of this 10 years. What's on the horizon now?
Well, as we've had a rich 10-year history, we've gotten a little bit better at looking further out. There have been times when it's hard to see beyond just the next year or even the next month. But for us right now, we're kind of looking at that next 10 years and saying, what could we accomplish over the next decade? And where exactly are we feeling our model needs to go? And is that continued geographic expansion? I think that's part of it. I think we might go outside of East Africa to other parts of the continent that desperately need this kind of model. But we're also at a point where we've said there might be extensions onto our model or new people that we need to serve that still are within that mission, but we might need to look at how do we take our model in a little bit of a new twist in the next 10 years. But right now, our core model and our core business, if you will, is this model that we've been doing in 40 centers. And over the next 2 years, we plan to open 20 more centers to get to 60. We've already got those really closely planned out. And then over the next 10 years, we hope we can impact 100,000 families and see more than 250,000 orphans prevented. And we don't know exactly where yet or exactly how, but that's kind of the vision that we're chasing.
That's incredible. So I do need to ask you this. Your role has had to shift as you go from just getting this cranked up, at one point thinking you're going to produce a documentary film, to the vision you just described. Just comment quickly on how your role has changed and therefore how you have to spend time on things now that you didn't spend time on before. And there's some things you used to do that you might even enjoy, but you just almost can't afford to spend too much time on those things now.
Yeah, it really has changed. And I've had to become a lot more proactive in how I manage my time and less reactive. I felt like in the beginning, any opportunity, any meeting, any speaking opportunity, anything that came along, I basically said yes to. It felt like a missed opportunity if I didn't. But as we've grown, there have been produced more opportunities than we can possibly ever accommodate. And so I've had to think differently about what are my highest value activities. And thankfully, what I've loved about my job is I used to do everything within Care for AIDS. I was the only employee. And as I've added team members, I've been able to take some things off my plate, either that I was not great at doing or things that I didn't really find a lot of enjoyment in. And I've found people who have complimented me. And so I've become more and more focused over time. And we talked a little about saying no earlier. I think I've read a lot of books on that, and there's a lot of great content on that. Recently, I just read Essentialism.
Yeah.
And that was a great read.
Greg McKeown?
Yes. And I recommend that for any entrepreneur who's about to see something that potentially grow very quickly, because you have to, he said, discern between that trivial many versus that vital few. And for me, I've had to be a little bit more rigid in how I've managed my time, but I've also still found ways to leave space to be available to new opportunities and people that might come along. But I've had to choose very carefully how I spend my time, because otherwise someone else will, as Greg says in that book, someone else will plan your time for you. And that is not going to get Care for AIDS to the strategic future that I want. So I've tried to think about my time in thirds. This isn't a magic breakdown, but I do try to think about the third of my time that I spend on developing the relationships within Care for AIDS for our donors, our board members, helping promote those. I spend about a third of my time trying to invest in my team, helping develop them, give them direction, coach and encourage them. And then the final third of my time is the time that it's the hardest to protect, but it's that time where I'm working on the next long-term strategic thing that's going to help Care for AIDS go to the next level. And there's sometimes those real urgent things that come up and that fight for your time. And unfortunately, that's the time I'm not as good at protecting. It doesn't feel as immediate. And so I don't do a great job of that sometimes. But I would ideally love to spend my time in those three buckets.
That's a great way to think about it. Well, if folks have heard this and they're going, wow, I'd love to be part of that, how do I plug in to Care for AIDS and actually personally have a stake in helping to not just transform lives, but to save lives? How do people connect? What would you tell them to do?
I'd say the first place to go is to our website. The website is careforaids.org. So careforaids.org. And on that website, you're going to find tons of resources and information about how you can plug in. You can sign up to receive information from us. You can partner with us financially. We rely on and are grateful for the support of individuals and churches and groups here that help support the work we're doing in Africa. You can even sign up to go on a trip to Kenya, as your wife did, David, and your son and daughter. And so those are some ways to do that. And I would say go on there. We have a free resource that you can download as well. That's just an ebook we created on the topic of generosity. We had about 8 different contributors write something as their perspective on the topic. And it may seem a little self-serving because we are in a fundraising organization, but at the same time, we believe that there is just great joy. And we don't want people to give begrudgingly. There's just great joy in living a generous life, not just with your finances, but with all areas of your life. So we wanted to create a resource that could help our supporters kind of dive into that topic. So go on the website, find more information there. You can follow us on Twitter, at Care for AIDS. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, all those social media sites. So we'd love to connect with you, and you can find my contact on the website as well and reach out.
Well, Justin, I really appreciate you being willing to come and spend time and share your story, especially after hearing you talk about how to be so much more proactive and you can't react to all these opportunities anymore. So now I feel really good. But thank you. You and your team are doing unbelievable work. What a great story. I mean, really inspirational story. So if you're part of the Launch University tribe out there and you're listening, I hope when you hear this, you realize that that extra effort, maybe the lost sleep, the time you spend working on your project, your business, your ministry really can make a difference. That's what we want. We want to help you be a difference maker. And I think Justin's story serves that point well. So thanks so much for joining us today. Spread the word. This is such a good story. Let me just challenge you. Somebody that you know that needs to hear the story about Care for AIDS, turn them onto the podcast. Let them hear Justin's story and be inspired to do their thing, or maybe even jump on board and help Justin and his team with their Care for AIDS work. Justin, many thanks.
Thank you, Dave.
Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Launch University podcast. We hope it's helped move you from go-getter to difference maker. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes and leave a review. Find more great resources at launchu.net.